I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. For over 2 weeks, violence has escalated in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The UN's top human rights official has warned all sides to not indiscriminately attack civilians and that violations may amount to war crimes. Joining us today to share some of their expertise in the region is Robert Pelletreau, former Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs and former U.S. Ambassador to Bahrain, Tunisia, and Egypt. Good morning.
Good morning.
And William Roux, former Ambassador in Yemen and United Arab Emirates. He served as a U.S. Foreign Service Officer in the Middle East for over 30 years. He's a board member of the Middle East Policy Council, the Public Diplomacy Council, and adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Yeah, we're lucky to have you both here in Woods Hole that we can share your expertise, and I'm anxious to hear your thoughts. But first, I'd like to play an interview we did last week. As you know, last week, Shibli Talhami was in Woods Hole. He's the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. We recorded an interview with him and we began asking him his thoughts on this escalation of tension and why now.
It's a good question because a lot of people, you know, connect it simply to two horrific events that happened. One was when Palestinians abducted, apparently Palestinians, they haven't been caught yet, who killed three young Israelis on the West Bank, and then Israelis who have confessed to killing a young Palestinian and burning him apparently to death. Those obviously are horrific events by any standards, and clearly the emotions were very much high on these issues. But the reality of it is these were just the sparks. In an environment that was highly charged. And we, you know, as many of us have been warning that it was going to happen. It was just a matter of time before this all, you know, erupts. Why? For the number of reasons. The first thing is, you know, when you look at all the attempts to bring peace between Israel and Palestinians, the reality remains nothing much has changed on the ground. The West Bank and Gaza is still under occupation, particularly the West Bank. Palestinians don't have normal life. The only hope was coming from the supposed activities of the international community to bring about a negotiated settlement for a two-state solution. And the Israelis have not really known normal lives. They don't have the same kind of challenges the Palestinians do being under occupation. But obviously, every once in a while, we see what has happened just now. They have these eruptions. So what we have seen is that over the years, because nothing was happening, and the occupation has been there since 1967, that a lot of people were really coming to believe it's never going to happen. In fact, in my polling, and I do polling both among Palestinians, among Israelis, and also in the Arab world broadly, what we find is in all these three communities, a majority now believes that it's never going to happen. Peace is never going to happen. When you start believing that, then and you don't accept the status quo, and then you add to it that there was a recent attempt by the U.S. administration that raised the hope a little bit but didn't work out, and then the Arabs, to whom the Palestinians look to often for help, are preoccupied with all their own problems all over the place, from Egypt to Iraq to Syria, then you see why, you know, they decide in some ways it was ripe for them to assert themselves. On the Israeli side, too, while the Israelis are divided, you know, on what sort of future they want, they're all worried about losing the Jewish majority. And the recognition that maybe there might not be a two-state creates a different danger of, you know, raising ultranationalism, friction with the Palestinians, friction at home with the Arab populations. So that was the environment in which these sparks happened. And I think it was only a matter of time. If it weren't these horrific killings, it would have been something else.
Yeah. You've said that there's a sense of alienation similar to the 1980s.
Yes, it's interesting because I was there, you know, in Jerusalem and Ramallah when all this happened, when the abductions took place. I happened to be there, and I, you know, went to Ramallah just a couple of days afterwards to see, you know, what the environment is like. And there was actually a strike because in the Israeli operations, a Palestinian had been killed outside of Ramallah, and they shut down the city. And my sense was that this reminded me of 1987. Now, 1987 is an interesting year because that's the year of the first Palestinian Intifada that took place exactly almost 20 years after the beginning of Israeli occupation following the 1967 war. And it was also, by the way, the year during which Hamas was started, in part to fill a vacuum because nobody was doing much on the Palestinian side, or so the public thought. Now, the comparison is really at two levels. At one level, you had the Palestinians losing faith in the Arab ability in the short term to do something, because then Arabs, who always focused on Palestine, at least rhetorically, and gave the Palestinians some hope for doing something to help them, were preoccupied with the Iran-Iraq war. That decade really frustrated the Palestinians quite a bit. And now, obviously, they're preoccupied with their own uprisings. And the second part was that then the leadership, if the Palestinians had to look to leaders to deliver, the PLO was the representative of the Palestinian people, but it had been exiled in Tunis, and it was somewhat disconnected from the public. So grassroots politics really drove the situation, drove the politics of the situation. And now we see, though, the Palestinian Authority of Mahmoud Abbas and Hamas in Gaza were right there. There was a growing sense that they're not catering, they're not able to deliver for the public. And so in that sense, I think that sense of alienation, that sense of frustration that no one is doing something on their behalf, and you add to it the hope raised by American diplomacy that didn't materialize, I think people were bound to take things into their own hands. And I think we haven't done that yet, by the way. We don't know that we're on the verge of a third intifada yet, but I think we could very well be.
Hmm. Well, how does this play into the broader regional changes in the Arab world?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this is a remarkable time in the Arab world. It has, in the short term, it's, as you can see, it's mostly negative. I mean, we've seen the upheavals, the instability, and in some ways even intrusions into human rights in ways that were not expected when we first all faced these early uprisings, when the images of Tahrir Square of people going there in the millions to overthrow an authoritarian regime, all of these raised hopes all over the world, I mean, including in America. I even did a poll here in the U.S. when you had, you know, a majority of Americans saying, yes, we'll support democracy, even if it leads to a government that's not friendly to the U.S. Now, that's astonishing in historical mm-hmm. perspective, in large part because they saw, oh, they're like us. They want freedom. They want democracy. They're acting. So there was this inspiring moment, almost romantic moment with the Arab empowerment. And now, of course, over the past couple of years, we've seen that the tide has turned into a very ugly internal conflict and a backlash in some ways against these uprisings. So what we need to understand in this context is that the profoundly new element in all this is that the information revolution has created a public empowerment on a scale we had never witnessed before. And that public empowerment, which also translates into an empowerment of the individual in societies when the individual had a much more minor role, both culturally and in family or society and politically, that empowerment is with us to stay, in part because this information revolution is only expanding. And expanding on a rate that we have not seen elsewhere, like just the use of the internet expanding 20% a year. And what that does is that it raises expectations. People know what they don't have at home by talking to someone else on the outside. They have sources of information that were not available to them before. Governments lose control of the narrative because people have other alternatives for information. And the interactive nature of the internet and the social media is empowering by virtue of connecting with other people who either share your views or respond to your views, and you can even organize with them in ways that you weren't able to do before. So that empowerment is real. It's with us to stay. But here's the other side of the story, and the side of the story that we're now witnessing. The fact that a publics get empowered is a progressive thing. In the long term, the very long term, it's certainly going to be good. It's good for democracy. It's good for human rights. But in the short term, it's highly destabilizing. And the reason for that is principally two. One is that when you have empowered publics, as you do, whether it's in Egypt or in Palestine or in Syria or anywhere else, the public is never unified. And so you have, you know, you have people who are on the left and people who are on the right. You have the rich and you have the poor. You have the religious and you have the secular. You have the sectarian, you know, the Christian and the Muslim and the Shia and the Sunni and so forth. So and everybody wants a piece of the pie. And what makes it very complicated is that public empowerment leads to the weakening of the central authority. When central authority is weakened, everybody starts being insecure and they want to make sure that they have that. So they turn to different identities, to different coalitions, and they become more competitive for power. That's what we see. The second thing is, take aside the public. The public is never the only factor in politics. So you have, they're still vying for power against the same old institutions, whether they're the bureaucracies or the corporations or the military institutions. And everybody is trying to have a piece of the pie and have the upper hand. So it's a prescription for more conflict in the short term. And the third thing is that when you have this kind of semi-anarchy in some places, at least substantial weakening states, we know that instability creates more economic deprivation and more insecurity. And the more insecurity and more economic deprivation you have, the more it plays into the hands of people who want to rule through the iron fist. Mm. And there's a backlash against opening. And that's what we see in the process. So in a way, all of this is taking place in a manner that is obviously preoccupying the Arab world in the short term. It's having an impact on the Palestinians because, in general, Arabs paid a lot more attention to them. At the moment, it's not that the Palestinians don't matter to them. People, in a way, the Palestine question, I call it the prism of pain for the Arabs. It's you know, built into Arab identity. But because everybody is worried about their own survival game, they're not paying a lot of attention to the Palestinians. That's when the Palestinians assert themselves. And when they do manage to get attention. And the reason for it is that if you have people preoccupied, let's say in Egypt, you have the Brotherhood and the establishment fighting against each other. Well, yes, that's what they're worried about, but they can use the Palestine question as an instrument because they know it resonates with the public. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Brotherhood will mobilize big demonstrations if this goes on for a long time, saying to President Sisi and the Egyptian government, you're not doing enough on Gaza, and trying to get sympathy that way. So that's what happens in the process. We're beginning to see some of that now.
Hmm. Do you think the end result will be a two-state solution or something else?
Well, you know, on the Israel-Palestine question, it's a fascinating story because I've been doing a lot on it for such a long time. And you know, it's as I had suggested earlier, it's gotten to a point where a majority of Israelis and a majority of Palestinians don't think the two-state solution is going to happen ever, let alone in the next 5 years. And actually, for those people who think the U.S. raised expectations too much by, you know, getting into this diplomacy, well, I did a poll in last November in Israel and in the Palestinian territories. I only had 4% of Israelis and 11% of Palestinians think that American diplomacy was going to succeed. Mm. So, you know, it's not like because they were already, you know, they weren't even paying attention to it, I mean, in some ways. And there's real reasons for it. It's not – some of it is deep mistrust, because the Palestinians don't think the Israelis would ever relinquish the West Bank. Some Israelis think the Palestinians would never accept Israel, or at least Hamas or FACT. So this deep mistrust, you know, that's ingrained now, that has grown since 2000 when the initial Clinton mediated negotiations failed. It's gotten a lot worse. But the biggest issue that has sort of influence people's assessment that maybe time is running out, can't happen anymore, the one that the U.S. government blames more than any other issue, is the continued building of Israeli settlement on the West Bank. The international community considers this illegal. The U.S. government has at various stages thought it was either illegal or just simply unhelpful. Every U.S. government has opposed it. This president initially called for stop to all settlement. It has never stopped, even in the middle of negotiations. And the Palestinians have lost trust. But more importantly, you have a demographic environment on the West Bank that is so complex. It's very hard to see how you can have an effective, contiguous, sovereign Palestine without dismantling a large number of those settlements. And so in that sense, there are a lot of people who think that it may have, the time may have passed. The U.S. government position is that it hasn't yet. And actually, what's driving all of this, in my own view, is that when you ask Israelis and when you ask Palestinians, even today, would you support a package that would include compromise, and here's what the compromise would look like, but take it or leave it, it's a whole package, not just issue by issue. I got in my poll roughly 60% of Israelis and 60% of Palestinians who say yes.
Wow.
So they still, in theory, you know, the public isn't the barrier to having an agreement. They think it's not going to happen in part because they don't trust the other side. They don't think the other side would accept it. But if they thought it was going to, it would happen, they would take it. The second thing that's driving the possibility is that when you ask them, so what would happen if there's no two-state solution on both sides? Would there be a one-state solution, or would be, you know, annexation, unequal citizenship? What do you expect? And majority of people think that would be violence for years to come, that this is a prescription for confrontation and disaster. And that's why they still, despite their pessimism, they hope. And that gives an opportunity for diplomacy. And it has given an opportunity to American diplomats who operated on the following assumption. And it's a correct assumption. And I know that to be true with Secretary Kerry when he first initiated his diplomatic efforts, you know, earlier in the year to try to get an agreement. His assumption was that Israeli public opinion will not be a barrier and Palestinian public opinion will not be a barrier. So it's really first and foremost, let's get a deal that is fair, that both leaders can accept, that both leaderships can accept. And they looked at the Palestinian side and they knew that they know what roughly the Palestinians could accept. They thought at least that to be true. They focused on the Israelis because the Israelis are the ones who hold the cards more than the Palestinians. And they thought to themselves, if we're going to do this, we're going to have to persuade the Prime Minister of Israel more than anything else. Not even his government, because his government is what we call a government of choice. He chose to be with right-wing members. He could still shift in within the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. There's still enough people on the left that he can actually broaden his coalition to have people who would accept a deal like that. So it's really about him. So it was a one-man strategy in a way to try to get the Prime Minister of Israel to accept a possible deal for a two-state solution. And they thought if they got that, then they can turn and try to persuade the Palestinians, and then they have a chance. Now, what happened in the process is they've reached a conclusion that maybe he's not capable of doing it. And more than anything else, the settlement issue killed it. To be fair, there's deep mistrust on both sides, and both made a lot of mistakes along the way. But I think that settlement issue is really the one that has been blamed more than any other.
You have done some really interesting research on empathy. And I think kind of surprising results. Talk about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we generally think that let's create empathy for the other in conflict. And so the Israelis and Palestinians, you know, here, they can't empathize with each other. And it's true. They don't, obviously, because you can see how they relate to each other in conflict. People demonize. So let's give them more information positive about the other, talk to them, you know, to train them. Well, what happens is that when you're in the middle of a conflict and you make an assessment that conflict is inevitable, that peace is not likely, then you want to harden your heart. And so even when you give people information that's positive about the other, that's supposed to soften them, they resent it instead of being softened by it. And we've seen that. I've experimented with that in both places where we you know, ask them how they react on the Arab side, how they react to movies or programs that are about the Jewish suffering in the Holocaust, or to the Israelis about the Palestinian suffering in the, you know, in the Nakba in 1948 when they became homeless, or even more contemporary and more equal in comparison, how they react to watching civilian casualties of the other side. So when Israelis see Palestinians getting killed, and when the Palestinians see Israeli civilian casualties, how do they react to it? And the first thing is not we empathize. The first thing is they brought it upon themselves because of that. And I think what we see in this, and we should understand it, is that at the core, when you think you have to do the fight, you just don't want to empathize. They don't want to play that trick. And if you play that trick, they see it as an attempt by you to disarm them, not to fight effectively. Mm-hmm. And we think that people demonize because they're terrible human beings. I think they demonize because they want to see themselves as human beings. And just to look at soldiers in the field, when you go out there and it's kill or be killed, and you have to kill another human being, it's very hard to think of that unless you thought of them as being horrible. And so that's what's going on. So therefore, I think my approach to this is the problem isn't so much the absence of empathy. The problem is people have no hope. And you have to create the hope for peace. And we saw that in the 1990s. When there was hope for peace, people were capable of empathizing. And people were empathizing with civilian casualties. And people were not hardening their hearts, but opening their hearts. So it's a function of the prospects. And unless you give people hope, forget about trying to turn them around by creating some empathy superficially.
That was Shibley Talhami, Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. We spoke with him when he was in Woods Hole last week. We'll hear from our in-studio guest after a short break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In studio with us is Robert Pelletreau, former Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs and former U.S. Ambassador to Bahrain, Tunisia, and Egypt. Also, William Roo, former Ambassador in Yemen and United Arab Emirates, and U.S. Foreign Service Officer in the Middle East for over 30 years, board member of the Middle East Policy Council, the Public Diplomacy Council, and adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Professor Talhami brought up an interesting point about hope for peace and that polling that showed a majority on all sides believe that peace will never happen in that region. What are your thoughts on that?
The mountain has been climbed so many times and people have then slipped back because they could not push it through. Each time it adds another encrusting of, is this really possible?
I think Professor Talhami's point is especially well taken today and probably tomorrow and the next day, because the intensification of the conflict makes people's hearts harden, to use his words. And the narratives on both sides, the Israeli official narrative and the Palestinian official narrative, is echoed by their supporters elsewhere. And, for example, the Israelis deny charges that they are indiscriminately targeting civilians, saying that the Palestinians have hidden rocket emplacements in mosques and schools, and they're hiding behind civilians. And Hamas responds that this is really not true. We won't know what the facts are, probably ever, and certainly for a long time, because the narratives today have become more mutually hostile. Hearts are being hardened. every day, because we're in the middle of a conflict and we don't have, the dust hasn't settled.
Right. It's an interesting article in yesterday's New York Times, and I'm just going to read there. It says, so far at least 620 Palestinians have died. I think we're up on that number. Around 75% of them civilians, according to the United Nations, including more than 100 children. Gazans did not get a vote when Hamas chose to escalate conflict, nor did they when Hamas selected areas near their homes, schools, and mosques to fire rockets from the densely populated strip. At the family house of four boys killed last week by an Israeli strike while playing on the beach, some wailing women cursed both Hamas and Israel. So I can't help but feel for some of these people who are really in a tough situation.
Well, it is so true that you have some truth on both sides, that in some cases, certainly, there are civilians being used as human shields. On the other side, there are cases where bombs either go astray or there's a targeting of a Hamas activist who's not really a militant. He's not a arms-carrying militant, but he may be somebody in the administration. And for Israel, he's a legitimate target, whereas the Palestinians don't accept or understand that at all.
Yeah. So I guess the big question here is, who can act as a mediator in this? There doesn't seem to be any one country that both sides trust.
That's absolutely true. Secretary Kerry is out there trying his best to involve the parties and be a mediator, but he can't be a mediator because he can't even talk to Hamas by law. American Congress has designated Hamas as a terrorist organization. He can't talk to them as an American official. Who else? In the past, we've seen Egypt as a mediator. In 2012, the Egyptian president helped bring about a ceasefire and a period of peace. But we have a different president in Egypt who is anti-Muslim Brotherhood. That's a main platform plank in his policy. And the Muslim Brotherhood being associated with Hamas makes him an inappropriate mediator for the Palestinians, certainly. We've even seen the ruler of Qatar, Tamim bin Hamad, getting involved because he is close to Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. But that's sort of a wild card, if you will. The leader of Turkey is trying to get involved. Even Putin made some phone calls. There are lots of potential mediators, and belatedly, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority chief, has gotten involved, and he's a potential mediator. But it seems to me the mediation won't take place until the two parties have decided that the costs are higher than the benefits. Mm-hmm. And that's the bottom line. They're not going to listen to mediation. They have competing demands for a truce. And that's not going to happen until they decide on their own without the exhortations from Washington or anybody else.
In other conflicts, you'd have suggested the United Nations as a mediator. But in the history of the United Nations in the Middle East and the United Nations relationship with Israel, Israel has no confidence that the United Nations can be an impartial mediator.
Yeah. Well, and I think it was earlier where Egypt had tried to negotiate a ceasefire. And I guess they talked with Israel. And then we were hearing in some of the reports Hamas saying, well, they never talked to us. We heard from the media that there was going to be this ceasefire.
Right.
So it's really important, I would think, to get everybody talking to each other before that's going to happen.
But right? There's no way to get everybody around
one table. Right.
You have Hamas leaders off in Qatar and Doha. You have Kerry talking to Netanyahu and talking to Abbas, but no way of talking directly to Hamas. Mm. And even Abbas is a competitor to Hamas in many ways. It's understandable that Mr. Kerry and Netanyahu might like to strengthen Abbas vis-a-vis Hamas, but Hamas is going to have a veto over that particular line of communication.
The other question is whether you link a ceasefire to anything else. And Secretary Kerry has started saying you have to deal with the underlying problems. Fine. What does he mean by that? Is he talking about the Israeli problems or the Palestinian problems? Or he's probably talking about both. And so each side has the linkage in mind that they want to attach to the ceasefire before they stop their hostilities. But the other side has a very different set of linkages. The Israeli side has talked about demilitarizing Gaza. In my opinion, that's not going to happen without Israeli occupation of Gaza, and they don't want to reoccupy Gaza. So, you know, what are they going to get short of that to declare victory? I mean, for a truce to hold, you have to have each side declaring some kind of victory. And that isn't yet apparent what each side is going to be able to claim.
Mm. So what are you, Professor Talhami wrote this up, what are the thoughts on the settlement issue?
He makes the point that settlement has never stopped, although it has. The United States has tried, other parties have tried to call a freeze to settlements or some kind of a suspension to settlements to allow some confidence to build on the other side as a practical matter. Settlement in the West Bank just hasn't stopped at all, frankly, since 1967. And I guess you could really raise the question today, would an Israeli government, even if it wanted to, be capable of completely stopping the settlement movement? The settlement movement has grown so strong in Israel and become so implanted in the Israeli government at different levels that it probably will continue in some form, no matter what the official attitude of the government and leadership is.
Right. You may remember that when President Obama was first elected and took on the Arab-Israeli conflict, he focused on the settlement question. And he tried to deal with that as a separate issue. And it fell flat because the Israelis weren't interested and it didn't get anywhere. It seems to me to have a resolution of that particular problem, it has to be embedded in a broader solution. As Professor Talhami pointed out, if you present both sides with a complete package settlement, then it's likely to be supported. If you ask them individually about the individual pieces of it, they're opposed.
You're not going to get anywhere. So what is it that each side wants?
Well, you look at it in two different ways. What does each side want out of a potential ceasefire? That's where the focus is mm-hmm. right now. Hamas basically wants not to just return to the status quo ante because they want to see their borders open to have relief supplies, reconstruction supplies able to come in. And without that, they're back where they were before in a completely quarantined, closed-off ghetto. Israel, for its part, doesn't want to go back to a simple status quo ante. Israelis are calling, that would be just like cutting the grass. It's just going to grow again. We need to have some greater assurance that Hamas is not going to be able to build more tunnels, import more rockets, and develop the capability to hit us harder again sometime down the road. So a simple ceasefire is not really in the cards. And a ceasefire with add-ons on both sides becomes a very complicated negotiation.
I would just add to that, that's a good summary, that Hamas, in a sense, has already achieved a psychological and political objective in that they have demonstrated some ability to resist Israel, some ability to fire rockets, however ineffective they may have been, all the way to Tel Aviv and beyond, and dig tunnels that even the Israeli intelligence, as effective as it is, didn't know about. So the Israeli objective is to eliminate the tunnels, eliminate the rockets. But how do you eliminate the rockets if you can construct them out of locally available materials? They had been, I think, importing some of these rockets from Iran, but I think mainly these are homemade materials. And as I say, they haven't really killed many people in terms of effectiveness, but they've shut down the Ben Gurion airport for 24 hours, and a lot of the flights aren't flying in there. And so they've done some psychological damage, and that's going to be remembered by the Israelis and a lot of other people.
Well, we've heard reports that Israel sent warnings of attacks, asking Palestinians to evacuate. But where do they evacuate to?
That's precisely the question. You have almost 2 million Palestinians crammed in this pressure cooker called Gaza. It's 25 miles long and only a few miles wide. There is no real safe area in Gaza that is not immediately vulnerable to Israeli firing, whether bombing or firing from the sea, or now that they've invaded, firing from invading armor and troops on the ground, too. It's a question any Palestinian family would have to ask itself. I have to evacuate. Well, where can I go?
It's a very good question. And if we're looking for glimmers of hope, which as diplomats we always do, it's possible that some of the blockade might be lifted or alleviated a bit in some kind of a truce deal. The president of Egypt has already talked about reopening some of the exits from Gaza into Egypt, which he closed and which had been open, and for humanitarian purposes. And if he eases that part of the blockade, you know, the Israelis may not want to ease their part of the blockade, but hopefully in some kind of a negotiation, if the international community supports it, there may be an easing of that part of the blockade. But that's one of the demands. And so if the enclosure and the imprisonment of Palestinians in Gaza is eased a bit, that will help achieve some of the Palestinian objectives.
We're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and we will talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with former ambassadors Robert Pelletreau and William Rue, who both served in the Middle East for many years. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Certainly a time of great turmoil throughout the Middle East. So how do you see this playing into the broader regional changes in the Arab world?
Well, the leaders of the other Arab states have their own problems, and I think their slow reaction to this current crisis in Gaza has been the result of their not wanting to have this added to their list of difficulties. The president of Egypt has huge challenges ahead of him. He has to fix the economy. He has to provide security. And the last thing he needs is a war on his border that affects him. And people are already starting to criticize him inside Egypt. And Professor Tilhami talked about the Muslim Brotherhood perhaps mobilizing on this issue. Because basically, if you raise the Palestinian issue to any Arab, they will react in support of the Palestinian side. And so he can't ignore it. The other states have also their own problems, and they have been trying to fix them internally. And the Arab uprising, since it started, has really been an internal matter. And the Palestinian factor has been pretty quiet, generally speaking, except for the 2012 incidents. So they don't need this additional burden on them. But now they have to. And Egypt takes pride in being a leader in the region, and it hasn't done anything to resolve the problem. So pressures are on him to get busy and do something about the Palestinians, for example.
Look at it also from the point of view of its effect on Israeli public opinion. With all this turmoil going on in Syria, in Iraq, in Egypt, all around Israel, for example, why would any Israeli government be willing to give up more territory in the face of all this uncertainty? There's much more of a hardening of attitudes and a tendency to fill the moat and pull in the drawbridge rather than reach out for more peace initiatives.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on the role, then, of the international community?
Well, so far, until today, the international community hasn't done very much to stop the fighting or prevent the ground incursion into Gaza by the Israeli land forces. I don't think the Israeli prime minister wanted to go into the situation, but it's escalated, and the violence has escalated, despite all of the calls for a ceasefire across the board, from Putin to Kerry to, you know, the ruler of Qatar, who have called for a ceasefire, and the Secretary General of the United Nations is out there. Everybody's out there saying, you know, ceasefire. I don't think they will play a role until maybe in the coming days the two sides decide that they will accept terms less than the original demands for linkage with ceasefire follow-on.
On the other hand, as Shibley Talhami points out, the level of distrust between the parties is so great that there's really no possibility of them coming together alone without some kind of a mediator to help overcome this very deep distrust. Mm-hmm. So even though the United States' latest effort at peace negotiations that had failed, there was no hesitation on the part of either President Obama or Secretary Kerry of plunging right back into this situation because a ceasefire was so essential.
That's right. And, you know, I don't blame Secretary Kerry for trying to negotiate an Arab-Israeli peace, as some people have tried to do, and said it was hopeless. Why try? I think any effort to bring about an ultimate long-term settlement is worthwhile. And the fact that he failed, perhaps, as Professor Talhami suggested, helped ignite the current conflict because it increased the despair on the Palestinian side. Nevertheless, he had to try. Maybe the comments in America and elsewhere that this is the last chance for peace deepened that despair when the chance failed. I don't think we should ever say this is the last chance. That's drawing a red line that we don't need to draw.
And another point that people don't often consider, but Bill and I would both recognize very quickly, is when the United States is involved in active peace negotiations and trying to bring greater peace between Israelis and Palestinians, it eases the work of U.S. ambassadors in other Arab countries because the United States is in there and involved. When the United States is not in there and involved, you find your access in other capitals is somewhat less and your reputation is not quite as high.
And there's another factor that always occurs when the United States is involved or not involved, and that is people around the world expect us to be able to accomplish miracles. And we're the superpower, so if we wanted to solve a problem that they're concerned about, we could. They don't understand the limitations on our power. And I think the limitations are very clear in this current Gaza situation, but it's not because for lack of trying, and it's not for the lack of American military power. You know, we could do it militarily, but that's not where we're about. President Obama wants to solve things diplomatically, and I think he's correct in stressing diplomacy, and he's on the right track. But people assume that we have so many other weapons that we can deploy in their favor. And of course, they disagree how we should deploy our military and other weapons. But we have limited capabilities that people don't appreciate that.
One of the other things leading to the despair was something else that Professor Tahami brought up, was this whole information revolution, where, you know, you're living in this situation, and now that you've got access to, you know, social media and the internet, and you're seeing how other people are living, you can see where that would, you go, hey, we want to have a normal life too.
Yes, that's a new complicating factor in that, frankly, around the globe.
Right.
But certainly in the Middle East, the globalization of communications means that young people in Egypt are not just aware of their own situation, they're aware of their own situation in comparison to young people in Europe or young people in China or young people in the next village over the hill. And that is something that's not going to change. That's going to be a permanent new feature in the environment.
Yeah. That's right. And the two current combatants are trying hard to guide the narrative, but the governments have lost control over the narrative. When you see Palestinian children killed on a beach, that video goes viral. Mm-hmm. And, the Israelis try to explain that it was unintentional, and the Israeli attempts are humane and civilized. But pictures speak loudly, and the Palestinian side can exploit that. By the same token, the rockets that the Palestinians fire into Israel destroy homes and cause some damage, so that, you know, both sides must take into account the videos that go around the world.
We have a couple minutes left, but I'm wondering where you see this going. And I asked Professor Tahami the question of, will this be a two-state solution or something else? What are your thoughts on, is this going to get worse before it gets better?
A two-state solution is, frankly, just as elusive today as mm-hmm. it's been over the last few decades. To my mind, and I don't know whether Bill agrees with this, to my mind, the most likely prospect going forward is a continuation of the current status quo, with times of greater peace and times of greater violence coming out, probably a continuing creeping forward of the Israeli settlement movement, but neither a permanent one-state solution or a permanent two-state solution, but a rather unsatisfactory continuation.
I'd agree with that, Bob. If you think about the two-state solution having failed, you have, and if you say that publicly, you have to say, okay, what's the alternative? And the alternatives are worse for both sides. You know, you can't come up with an alternative that both sides would accept. As Shibli Talhame has pointed out, you can come up with a package involving a two-state solution that the publics on both sides would accept. We have to get the leadership on both sides to accept it also.
So we've got a ways to go, is what you both are saying.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
All right. Former Ambassador Robert Pelletreau and former Ambassador William Rue both served many years in the Middle East. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your thoughts with us and your expertise. We appreciate your time.
Pleasure.
Our pleasure.
Also, thanks to Shibli Talhami for joining us last week. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands. Mm-hmm.